Hello, and welcome to the Green Minds podcast.
Showcasing the science, stories, and solutions behind climate change with Phoebe Scott,
Alex Miller,
Lottie Flashkus,
and Guy Wilkinson.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the IB Green Minds podcast. My name is Guy Wilkinson, and today I have the pleasure of introducing Mike Barry. Mike Barry, born at 322 parts per million, now we're at 415 parts per million, has been a leading voice in the world of sustainability, having worked at WWF and the World Environment Centre before becoming Director of Sustainable Business at Marks & Spencer's. More recently, he's acted as an advisor for the popular sustainability app Kogo, as well as an exciting fintech company called Climate. Mike, thanks for joining us today.
Guy, absolute pleasure.
Oh, thank you for being here. First question to start us off, really. You graduated from the University of Sheffield in chemistry. What did you go into immediately after? And I think more importantly, why did you go into that?
Well, I'm laughing to a degree because clearly I'm very much older than the average audience participant here. I graduated back in 1988, a different century. And I was actually researching as a chemist the impact of CFCs on the ozone layer. So the last great environmental crisis, 40 years ago, we were talking about it. Now it's all about climate change, plastics and biodiversity loss. I came out of university, went to a company called the Water Research Centre. So the UK water industry was being privatised back in 1992. It had a sort of government funded research part, spun off as a private company. Spent my first 5 or 6 years there as a consultant. Brilliant. Used to run to work every day, 5 miles along the river. Used to run back. Those were the days. Play football at lunchtime. But the key thing is I was working with the European Commission. I was working with the Hungarian government, the Estonian government. I was working with the chemical industry, water industry, starting on that journey to reduce pollution. Now, it all seems a little bit beginnerish now looking back on it. But at the time, it was quite radical and I really enjoyed learning there. But then a job came up at M&S back in 2000, an opportunity to really put sustainability at the heart of the business. And it was, you know, very early days for them as well. I was recruited by the chief financial officer at the time, a lady called Alison Reed, which seemed really odd. Lowly environment manager being recruited by the CFO. And she said, Mike, you know, a bit of an honest confession. There's not too much conversation at the top of the business about environmental issues, but I care passionately. I brought you in as my executive financial assistant to sort these things out. You've no line manager, you've no budget, just get out of my room and sort the green stuff out, which I did with a good colleague called Roland Hill, being at M&S for a long time, knew the ropes. And we built the momentum there. We really started to put, you know, deal with the environmental issues at the time, pesticides, wood sourcing, fish sourcing, those kind of issues. And then Stuart Rose, now Lord Rose, came into the business, fought off Philip Green, thankfully, back in 2004 in the pretty bloody takeover battle. And Stuart said, I want to be the world's best retailer on sustainability. People were starting to get interested. And over a period of 100 days working for Stuart, came up with Plan A because there is no Plan B for the planet we've got, with a number of other good people. 17 versions of the plan written in 100 days, launched back in 2007. And we'll talk about it a little bit later in the conversation, but drove that sort of into the business, its supply chains. Got my grey hair from doing it, some scars, some war wounds. Came out of M&S 18 months ago after sort of 19 brilliant years there. Been freelancing across the economy ever since, working with people like Unilever, SAP, GlaxoSmithKline, as well as Climate, Invest and Kogo that you mentioned, and loving it, really loving it. And it's a time of great revolution. And my final sort of introductory remark to all of you is, what a brilliant time to be getting into sustainable business. Because now is the time not for incremental, less bad business, it's for radical change in business models, which we'll again explore with Guy in a moment.
Fantastic. Thanks very much for that intro. And I think it's very clear, as I expected, you had a passion for sustainability and topics right from the get-go. Perhaps we could touch on sort of stakeholder engagement slightly, because you were lucky in that Philip Green didn't take over M&S, which I guess to some extent made your job easier. But obviously there are a lot of stakeholders out there who might be a bit more resistant to change. So I wanted to get your perspective on how, if you had any experience of that, how do you get them on board, particularly now that we have net zero targets in place that need to be met?
Yes, so Guy, I mean, there's an internal and external stakeholder. So back in 2000, when I got to M&S, right at the beginning of that journey, the business was quite insular. It didn't tend to talk with NGOs. So Greenpeace would knock on the door and say, we've got concerns about what you do in M&S in terms of wood sourcing or fish sourcing. And the business would just sort of pull up the drawbridge and say, we're not going to talk to you, we disagree with you. And, you know, I along with Roland took the business on a journey where it said, look, you know, we might disagree with people on the facts, but let's at least engage and listen and talk. And we went from being one of the most distant businesses in British business to one of the most engaging. And we didn't always agree. Sometimes we fell out, but we always had a very respectful conversation with stood where all these external stakeholders came from. And throughout my time at M&S and now working with other businesses, making sure that you're engaged, not with just today's hierarchy of leaders, but the new range of stakeholders that are coming into people's lives as well, critically important. The second part of it, though, is an internal audience, whether that's a leadership team, a boardroom, investors, employees, suppliers. And there it's very much about building the business case for change. Now, back 20 years ago, it was all about reputation. You know, we've moved on from there. It's about business model disruption now. So as I was leaving M&S back 18 months ago, the M&S food division had done a brilliant job at interpreting the rapid shift in concern about a meat-based diet to interest in a plant-based one, and launched a new range of food called Plant Kitchen. 60 different product lines, vegan, vegetarian, fantastically successful for the business commercially. They'd driven that. You know, I challenged them, I'd asked them to look at this issue to do with rising concern about meat-based diets, its impact on climate and other aspects of animal welfare and human health. But they responded and come up with a product that the consumer, the customer actually wanted, which was fantastic. And they did that because they knew they could grow the business off it and they would be more successful off the back of it. For other parts of the business, it's about motivating the troops. For other parts of the business, it's about driving down operating costs, less energy use, less resource use. But all the time, it was about building that sort of internal engagement around the business case. But the final part of the business case is recognizing there's a business that little old M&S can't change the whole world that it operates within. Think of palm oil sourcing. M&S was using about 4,000 tons of palm oil in 800 different products. It's a liquid commodity bought 6 or 7 stages back away from M&S. The chance of little M&S being able to reform that on its own make it sustainable impossible. But by working with Sainsbury's, Tesco's, Walmart's huge competitors to build the platforms to work together on engaging the sector on the other side of the world, critically important. So stakeholder engagement and the skills to do it evolve from just within your own business to be able to work across the wider competitive ecosystem as well to drive change. Stakeholder engagement right at the heart of the skill set that you need to do this. We'll talk about a little later about the 6 skills that you need to sort of prosper as a sustainable business person. The number one thing I look for: empathy, emotional intelligence, people skills. Because all the solutions we need to become more sustainable exist today. It's about encouraging people to want to do them.
Fantastic. Thank you very much for that. Just delving a bit deeper into your role at M&S, I was looking up earlier, just before this podcast, Plan A is M&S's big sort of sustainability strategy. Could you tell us, A, a little bit about the strategy itself, and B, you briefly mentioned there that you were very, very much given ownership of that without much necessary budget or reporting. So it'd be good for perhaps young professionals who are going into roles at large companies who are given ownership of a large, challenging task, how to go about that as well.
Yeah, and again, I'll take you back, you know, a long, long way back to sort of 2004. We'd fought off Philip Green in the takeover battle. Stuart now said, I really want to lead in this space. But the first 2 years there working with Stuart, it was very much about just getting the business in the right place to succeed in the first place commercially. Stores had to be shut, new lorries bought, new supply chains opened up. So our job in terms of doing corporate responsibility at the time was just sort of, you know, hold the fort, keep things nice and steady, don't make any mistakes. And what we did throughout that time was build external trust and confidence in the business, the stakeholder part we spoken about externally. And then internally, really start to help the business understand it was doing an awful lot of good social environmental stuff. It just didn't recognize it. So what we did is we gathered all that together. And we probably found that half of it we're doing already. It was just scattered across the organization. It didn't have an organizing principle or structure. Stuart then turns up and says, right, I want to be a world leader on this. You've got 100 days, 3 months to sort of work out what leadership means. Now, back in the time, leadership meant taking responsibility for your total value chain. What we're talking about, scope 3 emissions now. There's huge emissions for any retailer or fast-moving consumer goods brand supply chains. Now, M&S, small retailer, still buying from a couple of thousand factories around the world, doesn't own any of them. 20,000 farmers, doesn't own any of them. Thousands of raw material sources. We talk about palm oil, soy, cocoa, rice, fish, etc. 2 million people working in those supply chains. The other direction, 32 million people buying 3 billion individual items from M&S every year, and operations, thousands of shops, websites, lorries, etc. So scope 1, 2, 3 as we know it now. But taking responsibility for those scope 3 emissions in supply chains and the consumer's home had never really been done before. So M&S put its hand up and did that with Plan A. The second thing is M&S said we would really build a business case for change. We wouldn't just do this for reputational reasons or to win a few awards. It made good financial sense, save £750 million net over 10 years, the first 10 years of Plan A. Incredibly important. The third thing we said we'd do is we'd do it in partnership where we can do it on our own. Again, it seems very obvious now, but back in the time, it was quite radical. So we built a new way of doing corporate responsibility back then. As I say, now it seems very self-evident that you would do it. So the five phases we went through at M&S of building change. The first was to build a firm foundation, 100 commitments, social, environmental, climate change, waste, human rights, salt and fat sugar content of food. Just get targets in place, governance and reporting to make sure that you're on top of those basic issues. That's your credibility comes from that foundation. The second bit, drive the integration into the business. So it wasn't you as a small team of 10 people out of 83,000 owning it. Everybody did. So two brief examples there. Every one of those 3 billion items we spoke about at M&S had to have at least one Plan A attribute or story to tell by 2020, starting in 2010. Whether it's men's slippers, Italian ready meals, Kenyan roses, everybody had to think about sustainability and Plan A as part of their product mix. The second story, the M&S food division did a great job at building a bronze, silver, gold ladder for every food supplier to become progressively more sustainable. And in doing so, cut their operating costs, motivate their people, improve quality, better business as a result of it. But every food factory had to be participating. So that's the second thing you do. You drive the integration into the business. The third thing, again, I've referenced already, we're talking about much more partnership. Understanding where you as an individual business wanted to win. Plant kitchen, vegan, vegetarian range. M&S wants to win on in the shop. Sourcing soya and palm oil sustainably. Now I'm going to do that together with the other good retailers out there. We have to do it together. The fourth bit then is about engaging those 32 million M&S customers and 83,000 colleagues. And this is not just something that the business is making up. There is a really compelling reason we need to be doing it, that you need to participate in the change, give the tools to do it easily. And actually, if we all live a more sustainable life, things can be better rather than having to do it grudgingly. So really drive that engagement. And the fifth and final part is where we are now, very much in the economy, it's well-recognised business model disruption. So just selling clothing, wear it once and throw it away, as the fast fashion guys do, not sustainable. The rise of the resale platforms now means that people can sell something time and time and time again. Same with the rise of a plant-based diet, business model disruption, the rise of the electric car rather than diesel car, of wind rather than coal. It's all about business model disruption. But they're the five steps to get there.
Okay, fantastic. That's really good. A couple of points I just wanted to ask on that. Firstly is food supplier feedback. If you're M&S and you're telling your suppliers you need to be more sustainable, you need to treat your workers in the right way, what feedback have you had from suppliers? Have you had any that have been like, oh, you know, dragging their feet a little bit? And how do you deal with that?
Well, there's two forms of feedback, and you've got to be very humble about this. There's feedback from suppliers who don't want to do it, can't do it, or are demanding a 10, 20, 30% increase in prices because that's how much the greener option costs. That's a supplier problem. There's equally you as the buyer, the retailer or the consumer goods brand that are putting huge pressure on the suppliers to become more sustainable. But in doing so, asking them also to cut costs or to produce goods through the night because there's a rush for orders. You've got to look at your buying practices and make sure that they align with what is more sustainable as well. So there's a humility there that you as a buyer have got to learn, that your buying practices are often the source of the problem in the supply chain. But that takes me back to that bronze, silver, gold ladder that the food division did. It's making sure that there's a win-win. The M&S food supply chain was becoming more efficient, reducing its costs, more motivated, better quality, but more innovation, but also doing it in a more sustainable way as well. And everybody wins that way. So it's looking for those double wins that matter.
Thank you very much for that. And the second point I wanted to pick up on, you mentioned fast fashion there. To me, I think over the past 10 years, to buy a sustainable product, I think you there's a perception that you have to be at a certain place in sort of socioeconomic society. So only really wealthy people or the middle class, the upper middle class, can afford to buy sustainable products from M&S. But delving into fast fashion, which is sort of the very opposite end of M&S, what would you do if you were working with a fast fashion brand to try and make them more sustainable when margins are so thin already? And it's a volume-based game rather than, I guess, a quality game, which is what M&S play.
Yeah, and let me pick two or three strands up there. I mean, the first is all retailers are operating off 3-4% margins. There's no spare cash at M&S to be doing this any more than at Primark, at Aldi, at Lidl, at Tesco's. So I think all retailers are facing the same challenges in that sense. The second thing is just in terms of consumer insight. What consumers are telling us, and I think they've been telling us consistently now for a decade, is we want to shop more sustainably. But you keep telling me it's going to cost me more, or I'm going to have to sacrifice some form of function or quality or aspiration. It's going to look like rubbish or taste like rubbish. And I don't want to do that. I don't want to give those things up, but I certainly want the greener option. Now, what business lazily does, it shrugs its shoulders then and says, well, you can't have it all. You know, you can have a product that's cheap and nasty, or you can have one that's expensive and sustainable, your choice. And that's just crazy, because what in effect you're saying to consumers is, yeah, I'm selling you a product that's really bad, it's full of deforestation and unsustainable fish and human rights abuses, but that's your fault because you're not willing for me to pay me more. And what the clever businesses, the disruptors of today, are saying is, we will find a way of squaring the circle for people, of delivering them great products for them as individuals. So they look good, they're stylish, they're high performance, but we'll also do it in a dramatically more sustainable way in the past than the incumbents. So that's my second point in this. You've got to make sure that you recognise where people's heads are going. The greatest untapped marketplace need on the planet is for more sustainable products. I've looked at 160 research papers over Christmas because the kids are studying for A-level and GCSEs. And look, from the last 18 months, about how do you feel about sustainability, pre-COVID and post-COVID? Consistently, in virtually every marketplace in the world I looked at, 70% of people are saying, I'm really worried. You know, I can see wildfires and floods. I'm really concerned, but I want big business and big government to come in and start to bring me solutions. Once you've shown me what the pathway is, I'll join in. But it's 80% your responsibility as business, 20% mine. So I think the whole thing about cost is a real risk. And to be fair, a lot of the big supermarkets now that trade in that middle to sort of lower end of the marketplace in terms of price are doing as good a job as anybody. And in fact, if anything, it's been the luxury fashion brands that have been off the pace and actually have had to up the game significantly. They're charging you 10, 20, 30 times more for the garment, but it produces the same standards as the bargain basement guy. Now, they are improving. And the final point in all of this is, I think that there has been a little bit of snobbishness about sustainability or sustainable consumption. Unless we engage 70, 80, 90% of the population, not just here in the UK, but globally, in sustainable change, we'll fail. Because you can't create this little green oasis of 10% of people paying for the Tesla car and the expensive this and expensive that. 90% of people don't change. We have to democratise and make accessible to all sustainability. And that's difficult because I see too many big businesses now really focused on a technocratic environmental solution. It's a great target. Net zero, scope 1, 2 and 3. Love it. Really good. But they don't talk a human language of something like just transition. So what are you going to say to the oil rig worker that's lost his or her job because now we're all using wind? Wouldn't it be better if we actually help that engineer transition their skills so they can work on a wind platform? What do you say to the beef farmer because we're going to eat less beef? Well, we help them farm carbon. So I think the human, cultural, social dimension of sustainable change is just as important as the environmental one. And yet when I look at business commitments on sustainability, I see really bold commitments on the environment now. 100% sustainable raw materials, closed loop, scope 1, 2 and 3, net zero. Socially, all I see is we won't kill anybody on a building site. We won't poison anybody with our food. It's risk management. We need the same level of social ambition and sustainability as well.
Fantastic. Thank you for that. I want to come on to two topics now, which are more broad in scope. The first is carbon labelling. Will it happen? Why hasn't it happened already? And is it needed or necessary to provoke behaviour change?
I'm smiling because this is a little history lesson for me. So, literally, as Marks and Spencer launched Plan A back in 2007, Tesco's came up with a very good climate plan, part of which was to put a carbon level on every one of 70,000 different products they sold at the time. It was ambitious, and they tried hard to do it. And at the time, it was just too difficult. You know, it was costing too much. The numbers you were getting up were plus or minus 100% accurate. And consumers didn't know what to do with them. They had no reference point because there's no other carbon label going on, and climate sort of awareness was much lower. It was a valiant effort, but it was doomed to fail. It all went quiet then for 10 years because, as I say, you know, Marks & Spencer is a small retailer. It only sells 40,000 unique product lines. I'm guessing Tesco's several hundred thousand. The Amazons of this world, the big platforms around the world, are selling millions of unique products. So the thought of putting a carbon label on each and every one of them using the old paradigm of pen, paper, calculator and spreadsheet to do it, that's why you get grey hair. It's impossible. In the world of artificial intelligence, big data, you start to think about maybe it's possible. So I've got, you know, two concerns about carbon level of the past. One is, technically, can it be done? I think we're heading in the direction that it could be. The second is, do people actually need it? And to my point that 80% of this needs to be led by policy, government and big business, removing bad choices from the marketplace or penalising them with a carbon tax. Do I think that we then people want a carbon label on everything? I'm still sceptical. I think on certain very obviously high carbon products, a diesel car versus electric car, a joint of meat versus a plant-based diet, you might. But putting a carbon label on every single product, and remember, carbon's just one issue. There's an animal welfare label, there's a fair trade label, there's a sustainable fish label. It starts to get a little overwhelming for people. So I'm still watchful, but I can see some good work being done by Upfields, who own the Flora margarine brand, Allbirds. I can see Quorn doing it. I don't think it will be on every product in 5 years' time, but certain key brands that've got a strong low carbon story to tell, they'll be using it.
That's very interesting. Thank you. And the second thing I wanted to come on to, you did mention there that carbon is just one issue. And of course, another big issue is plastic packaging. And it seems like throughout COVID, plastic seems to have taken a back seat and CO2 emissions and climate change more broadly have obviously taken front row. So plastic packaging, why hasn't this been tackled to a greater extent already? Is it that there are no suitable alternatives out there? Or is it a lack of willingness on the part of multiple retailers due to cost, for example, or something like that?
Well, it's probably two or three reasons. I mean, one, there's a reason that we use a lot of plastic. It's cheap, it's flexible, it protects products. You know, people have got used to using it. Now, I make, and that's no defense of where we are. I'm just saying that's why we are where we are, because it's been, in some many views, a wonder material. Now, that wonder material, just as I saw with looking at CFCs back in the 1980s, was causing a problem. And you have to address it. Now, what do we replace CFCs with? We replace them in refrigeration systems with another gas, HFCs, which were much better for the ozone layer, but dreadful greenhouse gases. And we have to be really careful in hopping from frying pan to fire, which repeatedly the environmental movement has done. You know, and we encouraged people back 15 years ago to get out of petrol cars into diesel because it was better for fuel economy, but it caused an air pollution problem in cities. We encourage people not to have hydrogenated vegetable oils in food and replace them with something called palm oil, which brought a deforestation problem. So all around us, there's a risk that we'd hop from frying pan to fire. And I'm quite concerned about so-called biodegradable plastics or plastics that break down in the environment. They don't in practice. You'd have to have unless you send them to a professional composting facility run at 50, 60 degrees C. Nothing breaks down properly in your own compost bin at home. So we are, I think, at a crossroads with plastics. Now, we at M&S, we always pushed a journey of first reduction, because the business was using too much, simplification, going from 11 different types of plastics, all sort of combined together in a weird way that made it really difficult to recycle, to just using two or three monomers, much easier to recycle. But then again, I keep coming back to partnership. You know, no point Mark and Spencer backing one plastic, Sainsbury's another one, Tesco's another one, because it just confuses the hell out of the consumer and the recyclers. You need to get the industry together, as has started to happen in the UK with Plastics Pact, with RAP and the Ellen MacArthur Foundation doing a great job to bring all the big brands and retailers together to say, look, we need to reduce, we need to bank a particular material. And you can start to see some progress, and I stress some progress in the UK. But then you've got another challenge. A lot of the stuff that we collected in the past for recycling, we just shipped off to China and hoped it was recycled. It never was. When the landfill was burnt, it was chucked in the ocean. Now, the Chinese Fair Dues to them came up and then said, with their Project Sword initiative in 2018, we ain't going to be dumping ground for the world anymore. Stop. We're not going to take any more imports of all this crappy recycled plastic. So suddenly all the Western economies, the US, Europe, UK, have had to work to get to create their own infrastructures to recycle. Good. That's right. But that's driven up plastic taxes here, or will do, to pay for the recycling. And sadly, also means some of the stuff that's going to China to be recycled is now being dumped into Vietnam or Indonesia or Malaysia. And thankfully, these countries are now standing up as well, sort of saying enough is enough. But it's causing a big problem. You've got another problem then. As the oil industry that pumps all the oil starts to lose its marketplace for propelling cars, because we go electric, or for powering power generation as we go to wind and solar, where's that oil going to go? Well, the oil companies are pushing it hard, say, you know, more into plastics. And actually, I've just done a little piece of work with Unilever that's really interesting. Did you know that they're using 1 million tons of oil to make home care products at the moment? So the hidden use of oil going into consumer goods and the packaging as well. Now, Unilever have committed to one of the world's first big home care businesses, take that 1 million tons of oil out of the business, something called Clean Future, and by 2030 be free of it. Massive undercommitment, €1 billion sort of R&D commitment. But people are beginning to realise that plastics and consumer goods ingredients are this secret dumping ground for all the oil that's not going to be used over there is now coming in here. Now, at the end, cutting through all of this, the only way to deal with this is twofold. One is to drive up the taxes on materials that can't be recycled and not recycled. They have to be penalised out of the marketplace. And the second is that the retailers and the brands have to get really, really serious about working with the councils to drive this common infrastructure for recycling, closing the loop. We're sort of like a third of the way up the hill. You've got targets for 2025, 2030, 2035. Not quick enough. There needs to be an acceleration. So plastics, just like biodiversity loss, is a little bit hidden behind the world of climate, but they're all intrinsically linked. You know, plastics is using oil. Plastics theoretically, more than theoretically, is preventing food waste. And food waste is a massive driver of climate emissions. So all around us, these issues are intermeshed. And again, for you, the audience watching, one of your key skill sets working in the boardroom with your business in the future is helping the board understand all these multiple conflicting requirements. Right, I'm cutting plastics, but my food waste is going up. Is that good or bad? Well, we've got to find a way of doing the two things together. And that's the great challenge. So I'm looking for people who can deal with that intellectual challenge of multiple different overlapping issues that need to be managed.
That's interesting. Thank you for that answer. You mentioned very briefly there the Ellen MacArthur Foundation, which for anyone who doesn't know is a not-for-profit that focuses on implementing circular economy principles in lots of different sectors and business streams. How feasible is it to implement the circular economy in a business like M&S? I know that there have been attempts to do it in the past with different similar businesses, but they haven't necessarily come to fruition. So what are the challenges there?
So circular economy is particularly difficult in a retailer because you're selling so many different product lines made from so many different materials from so many different suppliers in so many different countries. If you're a fast-moving consumer goods brand, let's just use an example of a business selling fizzy drinks. You basically use aluminium and you use plastic. You can make all that plastic from one material, PET, and with time you can make it all from 100% recycled PET. It's a staggering undertaking. It has to be done. It's costly, but it's relatively, you're dealing with one issue. PET. In a food retailer, you're dealing with every conceivable social environmental issue, every conceivable raw material. So closing the loop there is harder. So what you've got to do is hotspot. You've got to find out the two or three things that make the most difference. Food waste. You know, we know about 30% of the calories produced on the planet are never consumed by an individual. you know, if we do the stats, it's the third biggest emitting country on the planet after China and the US, is food waste in terms of carbon emissions. So driving those carbon emissions down, both through better infrastructure to produce food in the developing world and a less profligate approach to consumption in the developed world, both in terms of factories, shops, and the consumer's home, is really important. Now, what the supermarkets in the UK have done a pretty good job now of driving down food waste on their own premises by improving how much they bring into the shop each morning, how they reduce it through the day when it's on its last day before it needs to be sold, and then how they donate it to food banks at the end of the day. All have got a good story to tell there. Helping people buy only what they actually need is in its infancy. And again, I like tools like Olio. It's an app that enables people that when they've got surplus food to find somebody in their neighborhood that might want it or to take it off them. So helping people reduce, and you know, there's a great story to be told about frozen food in this space, but much easier to store and reuse when you actually need it, rather than throw fresh food away as well. That's the next big battleground. So food waste is a massive issue. And not just in terms of shops and factories, but particularly in the farms. So helping farmers grow just what they need, not setting so many crazy cosmetic requirements, not to have what slightly wonky fruit and veg that everything gets thrown away when you finish with it. If you don't want to buy your potatoes as potatoes from the farmer, helping the farmer put it into your ready meal business where the look of the potato doesn't matter at all, it's just an ingredient. So all food waste is a critical part of the circular economy. We've talked plastics a lot. Third party is clothing, about 3 billion garments sold in the UK every year. In the past, you know, M&S launched a really good relationship with Oxfam called Swapping back in 2008, encouraged M&S customers to take used M&S clothing back to Oxfam shops to be resold. 3 million garments a year, Oxfam sold it, 2 million quid raised, spent in Africa, fantastic. But it was 3 million garments, it wasn't the several hundred million that M&S sold. Now, what people have seen with the rise of the resale platforms, the Depops, the Vestiaires, the ThredUps, the Poshmarks, the Thrift Plus, is that people now have a platform that economically, when they finish with a garment, rather than throw it away, back to the environment, they can resell it, good for the environment and good for them economically, to make some money from it. So the resale platform is incredibly important. And IKEA doing lots of interesting work now about their secondhand store in Sweden. How can they encourage the same mentality in furnishings as we're starting to see in fast fashion as well? So there are these hotspots where you can really start to make a difference. But then you've got a long tail of products and materials which are much harder to address. And sorry, the final point, just seen in France, a law coming in where the French government are mandating that producers of technology, phones, computers, have to explain to their customer how repairable the item is that they're selling them. So if something can't be dismantled, they need to put a big red flag on it so it can't be dismantled. If it breaks, it goes in the bin, to drive a behaviour change in France. I would like to see that adopted elsewhere as well. But again, it's very bitty in terms of our approaches.
Nice. That's a really interesting point. I dread to think the amount of e-waste. And I know the EU is tackling that in quite a big way. And I'm sure there'll be some incoming legislation, which hopefully will replicate. We'll move on now. I know you've spoken a couple of times about the six skills that you think young professionals and people in all areas of business need, particularly with regards to sustainability. Would you mind elaborating on those?
Sure. I think we've ranged across them over the last 30 minutes session, but I'll bring them together. So the first thing I'm looking for is emotional intelligence. It's you, the leader, encouraging both within your own organisation, the people who buy from it, the people around it, that sustainable solutions exist, that we need to use them. And by using them, we can get better outcomes, not just for the planet and society, but for us as individuals. So emotional intelligence is the first thing I'm looking for. The second thing I'm looking for is business skills. So in the old days, you could sit on the side of a business, remote from it. It didn't matter whether you're working for a retailer, airline, bank. You just wrote a report once a year, published it, met a few stakeholders and donated some money to charity. Now, as we talk about business model disruption, you have to profoundly understand how your business currently makes money and how in the future it'll make money. So the second thing I'm looking for is somebody who truly understands retail, or hospitality, or mobility, or fast-moving consumer goods. And, you know, for many people still at university now, I would say, if you can, do a graduate training course. Do 2 years at Unilever, HSBC, Vodafone, learn the ins and outs of actually how it operates, IT, HR, buying, selling, logistics, etc., before you try and specialise in sustainability. The third thing I'm looking for, we mentioned as well, which is I do look for somebody who's bright intellectually, but not who's creating unique new science, double PhD in climate science. That's important. Somewhere else, in the boardroom, your job is to actually triangulate all these half-formed information points to say, okay, the scientists are saying X, Tesco's are doing Y, Greenpeace are asking for this, policymakers that, investors this, a disruptor's entered our marketplace with a new alternative to meat. Based upon all those sort of half-formed insights, this is what our business should do in terms of strategy. So I'm looking for somebody who can turn insight into foresight into strategy. The fourth thing we mentioned as well, which is partnership. I'm looking for people who can work ferociously one day to help their business win by selling more plant-based diets. The next day, walk next door and work with your biggest competitor to find soy, source soy more sustainably from the Amazon, because frankly, neither of you can do it on your own. So the ability to both compete and collaborate is critically important. The fifth thing I'm looking for is people who've got a big vision for where the business needs to be in 2030. Not an incremental version of today, but radically different. But also can come up with a practical roadmap to get there. Where do we need to be in 2021, 2, 3, 4, 5 to get to 2030? Now, I meet lots of dreamers who'll tell me 2030, we've got to look like this. No idea how to get there. I meet even more people. I know where we need to be in 6 months' time, Mike, and then I'll think about where we need to be in 6 months' time after that. The skill here is to be able to do the two things together, the big vision with the granular plan to get there. And the final thing is the great intangible, which is courage, because it's bloody difficult. You know, the reason Mike's looking down here at you a bit knackered, tired and grey haired is I've had so many doors slammed in my face, even in a brilliant, good business like M&S, one of the most supportive in the world in this space. It's tough. And it's tough for good reasons, because people are dealing with Brexit and they're dealing with COVID and they're dealing with tough short-term marketplace disruption and competition, and you're asking them to think 10 years out. So unless you're driven, you've got energy, you've got resilience, don't apply for the job. If you have that, it's the best job on the planet.
Fantastic. Thanks very much. That's some, definitely some great advice for our listeners. I think to wrap this whole thing up, if listeners were to take away one point from today's podcast, or perhaps if you had one piece of advice, what would it be?
I mean, I'm going to say two things. I'm going to say, first, be excited. As I say, it seemed really weird when, again, a fairly young audience, you've locked yourselves away for the last year to sort of protect the health and well-being of my generation. Thank you for doing that. It's been tough for you. But we're now sort of stepping out of this incremental creeping world of being slightly less bad into this radical disruption where literally half the world's car companies will be around in 10 years' time because they've been so slow to respond to electrification. So every business model, every sector in the world is going to be disrupted profoundly by sustainability. And it needs good people like you to lead those transitions. Fantastic. But the second thing I'm looking for is leadership. And again, I think our industry has been far too populated by managers. Managers who can knock out a good report, you know, do a good life cycle assessment. You need it. But what we now need is leaders who can help an organization transform. And that takes me to the final point. Everything I've learned over the last 20, 25 years comes down to three simple questions in the boardroom. Why do you need to become sustainable? What do you need to commit to do to become sustainable? How do you integrate it into your business? The why is the strategy. I'm a diesel car company, I need to become an electric company. I'm a meat-based business, I need to become a plant-based one. What's the insight, the foresight, and the strategy that drives a different why for your business? The what's the engine room, the traditional science-based target, human rights target, audit, report, governance, critical. That's what actually drives change. And you've got to be the person that actually makes sure it happens as opposed to just being a press release. And the third bit of it, how do I integrate it into a big busy business? Every business forgets. And you have to make sure that you are making this emotionally relevant to all your employees, your customers, your suppliers, your investors, the marketplace around you, your business partners, etc. And this is the EQ bit. This is the bit where you take something that's intellectually compelling in the boardroom or a conversation with an NGO and actually make it relevant to people living their own busy, busy lives. And you just sort of reach in every now and again and start talking about science with them. You have to take them on the journey with you. So that's my oversight. Be excited, make it happen, do the why, the what, the how.
Perfect. Mike, thanks very much for coming on the podcast today. It's been a pleasure speaking with you. We've had some great tips there. Thank you.
Thank you, guys.